In his new book, Proof of Conspiracy, How Trump's International Collusion is Threatening American Democracy, Seth Abramson exposes a story that the media has largely missed, a pre-election geopolitical conspiracy involving Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Israel, and Russia that sought to put Trump in the White House and succeeded. The book is the story of international intrigue, whose massive cast of characters includes Israeli intelligence operatives, Russian oligarchs, Saudi death squads, American mercenary companies, Trump's innermost circle, and several members of the Trump family, as well, of course, as Donald Trump himself. Seth Abramson is a former criminal defense attorney and criminal investigator who teaches digital journalism, legal advocacy, and cultural theory at the University of New Hampshire. He's also a regular political and legal analyst on CNN and the BBC. Again, the book is Proof of Conspiracy, and we welcome Seth Abramson to the roundtable this morning. Seth, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
All right. Well, let us begin, I guess, with before we talk about your story that is told in this 592 pages, of where what we've been living through over the last several days fits into it, the president and his apparent relationship with Ukraine.
So the book Proof of Conspiracy is about a 2015 geopolitical conspiracy involving six foreign countries. One of those countries is not Ukraine. However, Ukraine is addressed in Proof of Conspiracy because in order for that grand bargain that was negotiated between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, Israel, and Russia to go forward, Ukraine had to agree to the deal. And of course, another party to the deal was going to be the Trump administration. The idea is that the deal would feature the dropping of sanctions on Russia, and that could not go forward as a new U.S. policy unless Ukraine agreed to it. And so therefore, there was a promise that the Ukraine would get a massive new contract for its energy firm TurboAtom to contract with Middle Eastern countries to build nuclear plant turbines across the Middle East. And that was supposed to be enough to get Ukraine to agree to this geopolitical conspiracy that was hatched in 2015. And so this really dovetails with some of what Donald Trump and his administration were doing in trying to covertly negotiate with the Ukrainians, particularly in sending Secretary of Energy Rick Perry to the inauguration of the new Ukrainian President Zelensky instead of Mike Pence. Rick Perry is one of the people who was involved in this massive geopolitical conspiracy in terms of negotiating a key element of it, and that would be the creation of a joint U.S.-Russia plan to build nuclear reactors all across the Middle East.
So not to put words in your mouth, but to ask this in the form of a question, so none of this surprises you?
No. I mean, I think that this pattern of behavior has been very consistent for Donald Trump, frankly, you could say throughout his career in business, but from the very beginning of his political career. There has been a sense by Donald Trump and those he works with that certain federal statutes do not seem to apply, largely because they will not be enforced. Most particularly what I've written about recently are the Hatch Act and the Logan Act. Most important to what we're talking about now is the Logan Act, which is the idea that under federal statute, a U.S. citizen cannot, under false color of authority, negotiate U.S. policy with a foreign country. I think what we saw throughout the Russia investigation was Donald Trump using his aides, allies, and associates to negotiate covertly sanctions relief with the Russians. I think that the Mueller report does substantiate that, and it does substantiate collusion, even if it cannot prove yet conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. And of course, what we're seeing here is the very same thing, covert negotiation using private citizens with a foreign government, and frankly, for the very same purpose, that being to extract foreign aid for an election in the form of fake news opposition research. To be very clear, opposition research that is not accurate in order to change the result, in this case, of the 2020 presidential election.
You make the point that this all started in late 2015, the working together. So who made the first move?
So the story of Proof of Conspiracy, and obviously it's a very long story, it's a 600-page book,
Right. Begins
in the fall of 2015, a meeting aboard a yacht in the Red Sea that is convened by George Nader, who ends up being a Trump advisor prior to the 2016 election, but at the time is working for the Saudis and the Emiratis as essentially an agent and a go-between with Russia and Israel and other countries. So George Nader convenes this sort of summit on a yacht in the Red Sea. And all of this, to be very clear, is documented by major media from around the world. Proof of Conspiracy is a book with over 4,000 major media citations in it. And so this meeting occurs in the fall of 2015, and the people present are MBS, who we know well from the Jamal Khashoggi assassination of Saudi Arabia, MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, and then the leaders of Bahrain and Egypt. And there's an agreement at this point to essentially create a new pro-Israel, pro-America alliance of Sunni Arab nations, but it has to choose a U.S. politician to partner with in order to establish this grand bargain that's also going to involve Israel and Russia. And Donald Trump in fall 2015 is decided by this group as the person they will support.
With that support, it was still, and the reporting shows this, but in your reporting, what do you see? That the Trump campaign still was looking at this more as a way of furthering his business opportunities, not thinking he would become the 45th president of the United States.
Well, I think that both things were true at the same time. Obviously, we know from the Mueller report that Donald Trump was secretly negotiating a multi-billion dollar real estate deal with the Kremlin in the fall of 2015 and was not being honest with American voters about his business interests in Russia and elsewhere, and I would add, including Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, there were a large number of people surrounding him, particularly Thomas Barrack, Jared Kushner, Michael Flynn, and a number of others, who believed that there was a chance that Donald Trump could win the presidency and who wanted to essentially fet these leaders of other countries to entice them, and certainly these other leaders were interested in reciprocating that attention, to try to craft, again, this grand bargain which would address the Iran nuclear deal issue that the Sunni Arab nations in the Middle East were very upset about. They wanted the deal ripped up. The Russians wanted sanctions ripped up from their 2014 illegal annexation of Crimea. And then there also was the desire by some of these people surrounding Donald Trump to make money off a prospective Trump presidency by creating a joint U.S.-Russia deal to build nuclear reactors all across the Middle East. Now, the way that this was sold to these leaders and the way this was sold to Donald Trump as a prospective Middle East policy at a time that he didn't have one in 2015 is that the result of this grand bargain is that it would lead to Russia withdrawing its support for certain Iranian proxies in Syria, withdrawing some of its support for Iran generally, which thereby would allow this new pro-Israel, pro-America alliance of Sunni Arab nations that I mentioned to ultimately make war on Iran, thereby making Israel safe in the view of the Israelis. Benjamin Netanyahu was very clear he wanted to make war on Iran. This has been internationally reported with these Sunni Arab nations and the United States. And then, of course, for Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they would suddenly become the major power in the Middle East. So everyone was going to get something out of this, and it did give Donald Trump a foreign policy both towards Russia and the Middle East at a time when he really didn't know anything about foreign policy and was getting fed essentially a foreign policy wholesale by, at the time in 2015, Michael Flynn.
Let us focus for a few moments on Michael Flynn, how he became one of Trump's top national security advisors and what he was doing pre-election.
So there's a very interesting story there, which is laid out in Proof of Conspiracy. But essentially, everything about how Michael Flynn becomes involved in the Trump campaign is something that the campaign, for reasons we don't know, unless explained by everything in Proof of Conspiracy, were lied about by the campaign. So, for instance, the campaign claimed that Michael Flynn had reached out to the campaign. In fact, that was not true. The campaign reached out to Michael Flynn. There was dishonesty about how long the meeting took. Apparently, the meeting was only supposed to be 30 minutes. It lasted more than three times as long as that. There was dishonesty from the campaign about whether Michael Flynn became a Trump advisor at that point. Donald Trump would later say that he didn't really know Michael Flynn until 2016. In fact, Michael Flynn became his top national security advisor in August of 2015. So why would there be all these lies from the campaign simply on the question of whether or not someone was advising them, to the point that throughout 2016, Donald Trump used Michael Flynn as his top national security advisor, but never named him to any of his three national security teams that were public facing, that the public would know about. And the answer is that Michael Flynn spent 2015 traveling to these countries that would be involved in this grand bargain, this massive U.S.-Russia joint deal to build nuclear reactors across the Middle East. He went to Saudi Arabia, he went to Egypt, he went to Israel. In fact, he made multiple trips to some of these countries. Of course, in December 2015, he famously went to Russia and met with Vladimir Putin and talked about U.S. policy with Vladimir Putin. And so that seems to be the reason the Trump campaign didn't want to acknowledge Michael Flynn, is that he was effectively, as a private citizen, in violation, it appears, of the federal Logan Act, negotiating U.S. foreign policy on Donald Trump's behalf with these six nations that were going to be involved in what I call the grand bargain.
So I assume it is not a coincidence that during the Mueller investigation, that Flynn is the first one to come up and have charges filed against him.
No, it's not a surprise, because if you look at the other individuals who were ultimately indicted, and of course there were a number of members of the Trump campaign who were indicted and who pled guilty and who became cooperators, all of them became involved in the Trump campaign later on. They actually had less visibility into what was happening on the Trump campaign in 2015 than Michael Flynn did. So, for instance, Paul Manafort and Rick Gates became involved in the Trump campaign in March of 2016. George Papadopoulos became involved in March of 2016. The two individuals who essentially had the most knowledge of what Donald Trump was up to prior to 2016 are Michael Flynn, beginning in the summer of 2015, and frankly, Michael Cohen, who had knowledge of what Donald Trump was doing and how early he decided to run for president and who he reached out to in Russia and elsewhere about his presidential ambitions starting in 2013. So I think Michael Cohen and Michael Flynn can really be seen as critical figures in establishing everything that happened, all the pieces that were being put in place internationally for the Trump presidential run, both prior to the announcement in June 2015 and then in the case of Michael Flynn in the months immediately after that.
Let us talk about Jared Kushner for a moment again, with his work in the run-up to the election and working with the Israeli government and working with agents and developing this foreign policy agenda for the man who would become the president and, of course, the president-elect.
Sure. So the role that Jared Kushner played in 2015 and then particularly in early 2016, and this is laid out in great detail in Proof of Conspiracy, is that once Donald Trump essentially received a foreign policy wholesale from Michael Flynn and those businessmen Michael Flynn was working with, including Bud McFarlane, Alex Copson, and others in 2015, he still needed connections to these countries himself. He needed someone who he could trust, who would be a regular go-between. Now, Michael Flynn did serve in that role, but Jared Kushner, we know that Donald Trump is not the most trusting person. Jared Kushner was, of course, part of the Trump family. And so what Kushner did, and all of this is laid out in the Mueller report, is he secured for Donald Trump individuals who were either foreigners or foreign-born, or who appeared to be acting on behalf of foreign nations, who could advise Donald Trump be from these six Red Sea conspiracy / grand bargain countries, and essentially feed additional advice to Donald Trump in real time about how he could message his plans to maintain the support of these six countries. So specifically in the Mueller report, we have Dmitry Symes, who's Trump's top Russia advisor. He is recruited by Jared Kushner. He is called by Vladimir Putin, a friend. And Dmitry Symes, we should note, and this is incredible, so I'll have to really clarify this for your listeners, Dmitry Symes was the top Russia advisor for Donald Trump, and he now works for the Kremlin in Moscow, making $500,000 a year on a Kremlin propaganda network, putting forward Vladimir Putin's foreign policy. The second person who Jared Kushner essentially recruited was Ron Dermer, the Israeli ambassador to the United States. This was very easy to do because the Kushners are very close friends with the Netanyahus. And so a lot of the contacts between Netanyahu's office and the Trump campaign came through Kushner. And then finally, I'll just mention one other, though there are more, and that's Yosef Alo-Taiba, the ambassador to the United States from the UAE, who worked with both Jared Kushner and one of Trump's two best friends, Thomas Barrick, to set energy policy. And of course, as I've mentioned, a lot of this is about energy policy in the spring and summer of 2016. For Donald Trump. So Jared Kushner played a critical role prior to the election.
When it comes to the actual election, how much do you believe the foreign involvement ensured the presidency of Donald Trump?
Well, I would agree with the intelligence community when it says that at this point it's impossible to gauge exactly what the effect in votes was of what we know happened in terms of Russian hacking and Russian propaganda. I mean, I frankly think that the better polling that we have is on the efforts by the Trump campaign, and this is discussed in my 2018 book, Proof of Collusion, to convince Jim Comey to reopen the Clinton email investigation in October 2016. We have a lot of polling to suggest that that decision by Jim Comey swung the election to Donald Trump. So obviously any actions by Trump campaign officials, and we have some evidence of this, in fact, a lot, to push Jim Comey to reopen that case would have actually helped swing the election. In the case of what Russia did, it's a lot harder to say what the impact was, but we have to note that it wasn't just the Russians. You know, proof of conspiracy establishes that you had an Israeli business intelligence expert who was sent to the Trump campaign by a member of Benjamin Netanyahu's office, that would be the Israeli prime minister, who confessed to George Nader that he had run a disinformation campaign that essentially mirrored in almost every respect the Russian disinformation campaign prior to the 2016 election. And moreover, we know from Nader and others that that campaign was funded by the Saudis, MBS, and by the Emiratis, MBZ. But we also, and there's an interesting part in the book about this, have a lot of evidence to suggest that the Saudis, in the person of MBS, were involved in what AMI, David Pecker's outfit, the National Enquirer, were doing in the early fall of 2016 in terms of hush money payments. And we do know that Donald Trump being able to make those payments and AMI having the money to upfront make those payments to former Trump mistresses helped him get elected. So I think that's part of the story, too.
One of the big takeaways from the book is, of course, that the 2016 Trump campaign engaged in much of the same disinformation techniques as the Kremlin, and in many instances used those techniques to dovetail with the Kremlin effort. It makes it unclear where Kremlin election interference then ended and the Trump campaign begins because of that dovetail. So the obvious question from that takeaway is, what does that mean for the 2020 election, given that from the Trump administration side of this, nothing is being done?
So 2 points that I would make in response to that, Joe. I mean, the first is that people have to remember that the New York Times reported that in August of 2016, August 3rd specifically, agents of Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE went to Trump Tower to talk to Donald Trump Jr. and Stephen Miller and to offer illegal election assistance to the Trump campaign that, in fact, we now know happened beginning after August 2016. And Donald Trump Jr. responded approvingly. So we have evidence that in 2016, when the aid was offered, the Trump campaign was willing. We are still seeing that now. And the fact that Robert Mueller did not charge Donald Trump Jr. with illegal solicitation of foreign campaign donations arising from either the June 2016 meeting he had with Russian agents or this August 2016 meeting with agents of Israel, UAE, and Saudi Arabia suggests that nothing has been learned by any of these individuals. Now, Mueller's reason for not charging Trump Jr. was a highly technical one. But as I've said before, Donald Trump and his aides, allies, and associates, if they see an opening to violate federal statute and face no consequences, they're going to do it more than once if they get away with it the first time. By the very same token, in the weeks before the 2016 election, we saw people like Eric Prince, Michael Flynn Jr., Donald Trump Jr., people who were either in the Trump family or advising the Trumps on foreign policy, actively spreading Russian disinformation nationally in order to try to win the election using Russian disinformation. And what do we see right now with Rudy Giuliani, Trump attorney Joe DiGenova, Trump attorney Victoria Tonsing? We see an attempt to get fake information from the Ukraine to spread against Joe Biden, to spread against the Democrats, to spread even against Hillary Clinton, though she's not running, to win the 2020 election. So the answer is they're going to do exactly what they did in 2016 because so far they haven't been held accountable. And unless Congress and the American people hold them accountable, we're going to see a complete repeat start to finish of what happened in 2016, in 2020, with the same result, Donald Trump winning election with the assistance of several foreign powers.
So let me ask this question, and it may come off as flip, and it'll be the final question, but it's one that I just kept thinking about in reading the book and just having lived the last 3.5 years. Is this guy, Donald Trump, is this guy just kind of a Mr. Magoo who is bumbling his way through and is just lucky enough to step onto the board that eventually hits the back of the alligator that lets him get over the waters? Or is he this evil genius?
So I came to proof of conspiracy through my background as a criminal defense attorney for many years, and also someone who was a criminal investigator, so trained in criminal investigation. And so my answer comes from that experience of working with more than 2,000 criminal defendants. And I would say the same thing is true with Donald Trump that was true with some of the worst offenders that I worked with, which was that they were neither a sort of Mr. Magoo figure, as you describe it, nor an evil mastermind. Rather, it was simply that they had, you might say, criminal instincts, meaning that their instincts were for their own personal advantage and to violate the law whenever possible, if it would lead to their own advantage, to do so in a sort of craven way that lacked any accountability, perhaps sometimes expressing consciousness of guilt, but sometimes not, accruing to the actor themselves, people around them who would be willing to assist them in their schemes, again, in a sort of instinctive way. I think that Donald Trump, we know from his business profile in terms of statements he made on tax returns, statements he made to banks to get loans, in terms of possible fraud allegations brought against him in his dealings with independent contractors, that he is someone who has honed for decades instincts that are, to put it in the simplest possible way, the instincts of someone who's going to commit crimes and violate federal statutes, both large and small. And now he's on a broader stage now, so we're seeing that writ large. But we also see someone who has never been held accountable for his actions ever in his entire life. And so when you have someone who has those sorts of instincts to violate the law, who never faces any accountability, they frankly don't have to be Mr. Magoo, or they don't have to be someone who's an evil genius. They simply have to have a lot of money, a lot of protection in the system because they are powerful and they have good lawyers. And that's what Donald Trump has. And that's what we're seeing now every day with this president.
The name of the book is Proof of Conspiracy, How Trump's International Collusion is Threatening American Democracy. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Seth Abramson, thank you very much for joining us this morning. A pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
The name of the book is Proof of Conspiracy, How Trump's International Collusion is Threatening American Democracy. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.